why this year's political focus is on women and the economy.
They've outlined an agenda that is designed to raise the pay for working women and their families.
Plus, a fracking debate that questions property rights. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Women are at the center of the political agenda this year. The overall goal for both Democrats and Republicans is to hold the congressional majority after the next election. Republicans have been labeled as the architects of a war on women because of a conservative legislative agenda that zeroed in on restricting reproductive rights. Democrats are trying to claim that outraged voting bloc by focusing on the economy. In July, Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi unveiled what she called her economic agenda for women. It called for more women-friendly policies like paycheck fairness, a hike in the minimum wage, and support for the president's early childhood initiative. The plan won praise from the National Women's Law Center, the NWLC's Vice President for Education and Employment, Fatima Goss-Graves, joined me recently to explain why getting this issue front and center in the national campaign is necessary.
You know, we think that they've outlined an agenda that at bottom is designed to raise the pay for working women and their families. And it's very much like our agenda.
And explain more about what the Women's Law Center is.
So we are over 40 years old and have been advocating for policies that will help women and their families for all of that time. We have three areas of focus: education and employment, health and reproductive rights, and family economic security. And in many ways, the women's economic agenda touches on so much of the work we do. Many workplaces have policies that are have not caught up with this century. And whether we're talking about, you know, not having paid leave or paid sick days, you know, those sort of basic things will really help to advance women in the workplace. And then the last thing I'll just add is that we spent a long time working in support of raising the minimum wage, and that was a really central part of the women's economic agenda, and we were thrilled to see that.
And this is something, obviously it's an important agenda, but it's something that probably is difficult to push at a time when we're just coming out of really rough economic times, and many people are still in very tough economic times. And conservative lawmakers will say, well, now is not the time to raise the minimum wage. Now is not the time to put in more worker-friendly policies because you're putting too much of a burden on companies. How do you counteract that argument?
Well, I think some arguments are the same arguments that have been made time and time again, generation after generation. And in truth, the sky hasn't fallen. You know, what ends up happening is when the minimum wage is raised, then that means that there is more money for people to spend and the economy grows as a whole. And it is true that when workers feel that they are being paid fairly, then they are more likely to be productive and successful in their jobs. And having fair workplace policies and having policies that ensure that women do not experience discrimination in the workplace, those are sort of basic things that will ensure that you are attracting the right sort of talent and keeping the right sort of talent rather than underpaying them or treating them unfairly when they're working.
Fatima, do you think there's still some educating of the public that needs to be done, since if you are a woman and have experienced these inequities, you know it's true, and yet you will hear many people say, oh no, this is 2013, that doesn't exist anymore?
Well, I do think that there probably needs to be some additional education and really telling the public about the agenda, and I hope that we will see you know, campaign-style public education on it so that it is heard over and over again. But what's interesting is that when there has been polling on this, people support pretty intensely doing things and investing in equal pay and pay equity workplace policies. That's usually at the front of voters' minds and of the public more generally's minds. And that's typically true whether you are polling people in the West or East, in the North or the South. And it is true Republican and Democrats that these are issues that really resonate.
And the fact is, like so many things, this doesn't exist in a vacuum. If you can improve work conditions, it impacts education, it impacts family life, and so many other things.
There's no question. I mean, there have been studies that have demonstrated that, decreasing the wage gap, making that wage gap smaller, that alone would be a huge driver of addressing poverty. None of these issues operate in a vacuum. And I think that is what it makes sense about the women's economic agenda, because it is an agenda that groups together some of the key issues that women in the workplace are facing and says we can address this in a holistic way.
Fatima Goss-Graves is Vice President for Education and Employment at the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C. The current economic turmoil has led to chaos in many governments and revolutions that have gone wrong. Jill Malkin is here with Women in History, demonstrating that history does tend to repeat.
It may be fun to fantasize that if we were suddenly thrust into the position of a national leader or king, that we would be benevolent, a champion of the poor, we'd reform all the corruption and nepotism that taints the system. But just being in that position brings with it a permanent complicity. Such a victim was Marie Antoinette, Queen of France during the French Revolution, and who never said, "Let them eat cake." She was a musician and a patron of the arts and met her responsibilities as matron of the court extremely well, reinstating the festive court balls and promoting the arts. She was a graceful dancer and had a charming personality. She kept close contact with her mother and family in Austria, even to the point of being accused by some of extending them more of her sympathies than to her own people. Inasmuch as she was able, she kept politics at an arm's length. But during this time, the peasants of France were becoming poorer and hungry, and the nation's finances alarmingly chaotic. In May of 1789, the king gathered the Estates General, the French Congress, which had not been called to meet in 175 years, to establish and enforce the future of the country. But things went badly, to put it mildly. And on July 14th, the people of Paris stormed the Bastille, a huge dungeon and gunpowder depot in the middle of Paris. The revolution had begun. The king and queen made it known that they would work with the people to achieve a workable compromise and a lasting peace. The king and queen sought support from other European royalty to back them up in order to contain the uprising, but these others were exceedingly nervous at the thought of such events spreading into their own backyards. Soon papers were discovered which exposed the king's appeals for help to France's neighbors, and the jig was up. He and the queen were charged with treason. He was tried and executed by guillotine on January 21st, 1793. At her trial in October of 1793, the indictment read against her included squandering the money of the country, of conspiring with others outside the country, and of setting French people against each other. Throughout it all, Marie Antoinette kept her composure and replied clearly and articulately to deny the accusations. At this time, Marie Antoinette was weak, having been subject to hemorrhages in the time leading up to the trial. By the end of the second day, the queen asked for a drink of water. No one moved. Then the gendarme who was guarding her obliged her request. He was thrown into prison the next morning for his trouble. The jury returned after an hour, and pronounced her guilty, and she was condemned to death. The next morning, Marie-Antoinette was driven in a cart to the place of execution. Marie-Antoinette ascended the stairs of the scaffold by herself and calmly let the revolution do its worst. There's no denying that the idea of a people wresting themselves from a despotic monarchy to evolve into a people's republic is a worthy one. Of course, they couldn't have known what they were in for. That in July, right between the two executions, a young Corsican lieutenant guided his artillery battalion to take their southern port of Toulon and would emerge as the most absolute in their history of monarchs, a young man named Napoleon Bonaparte. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, musician, and actor. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. Up next, when fracking moves into the neighborhood, you might not have a say about what happens below your land. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1258. We've talked about hydraulic fracturing for natural gas before on this program. According to real estate tradition and law, buying a property means you own not only the land, but what's below the land, and even the airspace above it. But when what's below your land is shale, and your neighbor leases his property to a natural gas company, some landowners are discovering that they no longer have any say about what happens below their homes. If you think they're getting paid, think again.
Don Barrett is a lawyer from Mississippi. He says Southwest Virginia landowners have been victimized for a long time.
So we got to looking into it, and we realized that the injustice that's going on in Southwest Virginia is by far worse than anything we've seen in anywhere else. They've been abused by the energy companies in connection with this gas for over 20 years. And there's something that can be done. There's nothing that can be done. You can't go back and say, well, those people shouldn't have sold their coal rights in 1880 for 20 cents an acre. They didn't know what they were doing. All that's true, and it was a terrible mistake that everybody made. They were sold a bill of goods back in the 1880s, and they wound up, essentially giving away the coal rights to these northern moneyed interests. And it made them serfs, on their own land. It really dispossessed them from any real right to their land and the rights that land ownership traditionally means in the United States, an independence, for example. They became totally dependent on the Yankee mine operators, and so they've suffered under that for all these years.
That was attorney Don Barrett. We talked to him because he's part of a major lawsuit that challenges the way tens of millions of dollars of royalty payments are distributed. To explain the case involves explaining two concepts, force pooling and escrow.
My sister called me. She said, you'd better get here in a hurry because they're going to force pool the gas from under our land. Force pooling means that one hasn't given one's consent to the taking of the gas under one's land. Interestingly enough, it's called forced pooling.
Juanita Snavyock found out about forced pooling when a company proposed to take gas from her family's land in Dickinson County, Virginia. A gas well pulls gas not just from the tract where the well sits, but from under a lot of surrounding land as well. This area is called the drilling unit. It doesn't take unanimous consent of the landowners to get gas out of a drilling unit. In all states, the law provides that a percentage of landowners can make an agreement that will be binding on everyone.
Virginia has a very low percentage. Owners of only 1/4 of the land can trigger an agreement. So, for example, if a drilling unit covers 200 acres, The owners of only 50 acres can make a deal that will bind the owners of the other 150. They've been force-pulled. Disputes under the law go to the Virginia Oil and Gas Board, as Juanita Snavyak did.
After we did our presentations and I felt they were strong, they were good, I said to the board, "We're going to stand up now, and you look us in the eye, and you tell us that you are going to take what belongs to us." Gladys, Joe, and I stood up. The board, not unanimously, but the majority of the board, voted to force pull the gas that was under our surface land on Backbone Ridge.
When gas is force pulled, the law prescribes the arrangement between landowner and gas company. In Virginia, this law was enacted in 1990.
Part of this law said to gas industry, if you will go and develop and drill gas wells, then you may keep 87.5%, or that's the same as 7/8 of whatever profit you derive from producing this gas. And you must give to the people 1/8, or the equivalent of 12.5%, do the same thing. And this 12.5%, if there's any contention about whose 12.5% this is, since it's in contention, in many cases, in most cases, it's in contention, then the Virginia Gas and Oil Board said, well, we will put that amount into escrow until there's some resolution to this conflict.
So an escrow fund was created with the 12.5%. Over the past 20 years, this fund has paid out very little, and it now stands at $27 million. That seems like a lot of money at first glance, but some say it isn't nearly as much as it should be. Dickinson County landowner Ronnie Osborne.
We've been going over for what? How many years?
Since 93.
On and off. We've been going pretty regular. Wow. We've been going pretty regular for a while. And things that I have saw... Why is nobody listening to the landowners? When these companies, one of them showed in the paper that they made like $4.5 billion, and we got out of, I don't know how many gas companies is over there, and I don't really know exactly how many counties, but I think about five counties or six counties, aren't they? And the escrow's just $26 million. This one company in Buchanan County made $4.5 billion, and 12.5% is, and we, over 20-some year, ain't it?
Well, 93.
Our escrow is just $26 million. You hear some of them brag, oh, that's a big lump sum. No, that's not no big lump sum when you, 1 year, $4.5 billion, $26 million ain't nothing. That's a grain of sand, and I'm sure... If the IRS would audit and the FBI would investigate, I'm sure that escrow would grow like you wouldn't believe. I mean, that's my opinion. I believe it would grow like you wouldn't believe.
The state is conducting an audit of the gas royalty accounts. But the matter is also the subject of a major lawsuit, a class action in federal court brought by an organization called Virginia Gas Owners Litigation Group. Don Barrett is lead attorney in the action. He says the money shouldn't be in escrow at all, that the law is clear, the gas belongs to the surface owner.
It's funny, and to me it's providential. The Lord has provided a way here. All the injustice these people suffered, and then in the 1980s, they discovered a way down in Alabama, they discovered a way to commercially produce the methane gas in the coal seams. And all of a sudden, overnight, the natural gas, this methane gas, all it is natural gas, became more valuable than the coal. And guess what? The landowners still own it. Of course, the coal companies denied that and said, oh, no, it's ours. It's coal bed methane, ain't it? You know, it says coal bed, doesn't it? We're going to take it. And they set about to do that. But the Supreme Court of Virginia on March 5, 2005, in a decision called the Harrison Wyatt versus Ratliff case, ruled that, no sir, Mr. Coal Company, you do not own it. It belongs to the landowner. And they've ignored that ruling of the Virginia Supreme Court. They've taken advantage of the fact that there's no class action in state court, that very few of the lawyers in Southwest Virginia are willing to take a case against the coal company. So they took advantage of that, and they've taken it, and they have continued to drill these wells, taking coal bed methane that they know that these landowners own against their will. And there's going to be a day of reckoning. And it's going to be in the federal courthouse in Abingdon, Virginia.
The lawsuit doesn't stop there. It alleges that gas companies have underpaid the royalties that have gone into escrow.
Every one of these escrow accounts that we've looked at are woefully underfunded. Is that intentional? You know, we want to get in their book. We're going to get in their books. We're going to find out. We think that, you know, and we think that we'll get some answers. And I don't know how much you want to get into it, but we think that they have deliberately put not enough money into escrow, that they have charged fees that they shouldn't have charged. They have overcharged for things that they had a right to charge for. They have just simply not paid what they owed in other instances. They failed to report income. We think that they are siphoning off some of the gas and not paying for it. We think they're selling it to affiliates that are not an arm's length transaction, not for a fair price. But there's a lot more even than that. We think it's unconstitutional for the legislature to take something that belongs to a citizen and give it to another citizen. I mean, that's unconstitutional. You can't do, even if it's for a good purpose.
The lawsuit over gas royalties has been successful so far. The court will likely make a final decision sometime in 2012. If the lawsuit succeeds, tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars could change hands. Defendants in the case are two large gas companies, EQT and CNX. A third company, Chesapeake, settled out of court in October of 2011. Kevin West, Director of Public Information at EQT, says his company has followed the law and has nothing to worry about.
As far as the forced pooling statute, we acted pursuant to the statute, as did other producers. General Assembly, and it acted the statute and provided for a mechanism with regard to pooling of interest, and then when there was a question as to the ownership of the coal bed methane, that in those instances that those amounts were to be paid into escrow, which is what we did, followed the statute. And in any instances in which we sought pooling and that issue occurred, we paid it into the court. You know, it's our position that we paid everything into the escrow that was required by the Virginia Gas and Oil Board. And so for that reason, you know, we were in compliance and have stated that position in our pleadings.
Kevin West, spokesman for EQT.
This is the third installment of a radio documentary on natural gas drilling in Southwest Virginia and Eastern Kentucky from NPR affiliate WMMT. For more information about gas drilling in the coal fields, check out fracturedappalachia.org. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.